ushered into the Holy of Holies. The Commandant was in his wheelchair. We never saw him out of it except Saturday inspection and parade. I guess walking hurt. But that didn't mean you didn't see him. You could be working a prob at the board, turn around, and find that wheelchair behind you, and Colonel Nielsen reading your mistakes. He never interrupted. There was a standing order not to shout attention. But it's disconcerting. There seemed to be about six of him. The Commandant had a permanent rank of Fleet General. Yes, that Nielsen. His rank as Colonel was temporary, pending second retirement, to permit him to be Commandant. I once questioned the paymaster about this and confirmed what the regulations seemed to say. The Commandant got only the pay of a Colonel, but would revert to the pay of a Fleet General on the day he decided to retire again. Well, as A says, it takes all sorts. I can't imagine choosing half pay for the privilege of riding herd on cadets. Colonel Nielsen looked up and said, "Morning, gentlemen. Make yourselves comfortable." I sat down, but wasn't comfortable. He glided over to the coffee machine, drew four cups, and Hassan helped him deal them out. I didn't want coffee, but a cadet doesn't refuse the Commandant's hospitality. He took a sip. "I have your orders, gentlemen," he announced, "and your temporary commissions." He went on, "But I want to be sure you understand your status." We had already been lectured about this. We were going to be officers just enough for instruction and testing. Supernumerary, probationary, and temporary. Very junior, quite superfluous, on good behavior, and extremely temporary. We would revert to cadet when we got back, and could be busted at any time by the officers examining us. We would be temporary third lieutenants, a rank as necessary as feet on a fish, wedged into the hairline between fleet sergeants and real officers. It is as low as you can get and still be called an officer. If anybody ever saluted a third lieutenant, the light must have been bad. "Your commission reads third lieutenant," he went on, "but your pay stays the same. You continue to be addressed as Mr. The only change in uniform is a shoulder pip even smaller than cadet insignia. You continue under instruction, since it has not been yet settled that you are fit to be officers." The colonel smiled. "So why call you a third lieutenant?" I had wondered about that. Why this whoop-de-doo of commissions that weren't real commissions? Of course I knew the textbook answer. "Mr. Bird," the commandant said, "to place us in the line of command, sir." "Exactly." Colonel glided to a TO on one wall. It was the usual pyramid, with chain of command defined all the way down. "Look at this." He pointed at a box connected to his own by a horizontal line. It read, "Assistant to Commandant, Miss Kendrick." "Gentlemen," he went on, "I would have trouble running this place without Miss Kendrick. Her head is a rapid access file to everything that happens around here." He touched a control on his chair and spoke to the air. "Miss Kendrick, what mark did Cadet Bird receive in military law last term?" Her answer came back at once. 93%, Commandant." "Thank you," he continued. "You see, I sign anything if Miss Kendrick has initialed it. I would hate to have an investigating committee find out how often she signs my name and I don't even see it. Tell me, Mr. Bird, if I drop dead, does Miss Kendrick carry on to keep things moving?"
Why,
Birdie looked puzzled. "I suppose with routine matters, she would do what was necessary."
"She wouldn't do a blessed thing," the colonel thundered,
"until Colonel Chauncey told her what to do. His way. She is a very smart woman and understands what you apparently do not. Namely,
that she is not in the line of command and has no authority. He went on, line of command isn't just a phrase. It's as real as a slap in the face. If I ordered you to combat as a cadet, the most you could do would be to pass along somebody else's orders. If your platoon leader bought it and you then gave an order to a private, a good order, sensible and wise, you would be wrong and he would be just as wrong if he obeyed it. Because a cadet cannot be in the line of command. A cadet has no military existence, no rank, and is not a soldier. He is a student who will become a soldier, either an officer or at his former rank. While he is under army discipline, he is not in the army. That is why a zero, a knot with no rim, if a cadet wasn't even in the army. Colonel, hey, speak up, young man, Mr. Rico. I had startled myself, but I had to say it. But if we aren't in the army, then we aren't MI, sir. He blinked at me. This worries you? I don't believe I like that much, sir. I didn't like it at all. I felt naked. I see. He didn't seem displeased. You let me worry about the space lawyer aspects of it, son. But that's an order. You are technically not an MI, but the MI hasn't forgotten you. The MI never forgets its own, no matter where they are. If you are struck dead this instant, you will be cremated as Second Lieutenant Juan Rico, Mobile Infantry of... Colonel Nielsen stopped. Miss Kendrick, what was Mr. Rico's ship? The Roger Young. Thank you. He added, in and of TFCT Roger Young, assigned to Mobile Combat Team 2nd Platoon of George Company, 3rd Regiment, 1st Division MI. The Roughnecks, he recited with relish, not consulting anything once he had been reminded of my ship. A good outfit, Mr. Rico. Proud and nasty. Your final orders go back to them for taps, and that's the way your name will read in Memorial Hall. That's why we always commission a dead cadet, son, so we can send him home to his mates. I felt a surge of relief and homesickness and missed a few words. Lipped button while I talk. We'll have you back in the MI where you belong. You must be temporary officers for your apprentice crews, because there is no room for deadheads in a combat drop. You'll fight and take orders and give orders. Legal orders, because you will hold rank and be ordered to serve in that team. That makes any order you give in carrying out your assigned duties as binding as one signed by the CNC. Even more, the commandant went on, once you are in line of command, you must be ready instantly to assume higher command. If you are in a one platoon team, quite likely in the present state of the war, and you are assistant platoon leader when your platoon leader buys it, then you are it. He shook his head. Not acting platoon leader, not a cadet leading a drill, not a junior officer under instruction. Suddenly you are the old man, the boss, commanding officer present, and you discover with a sickening shock that fellow human beings are depending on you alone to tell them what to do, how to fight, how to complete the mission and get out alive. They wait for the sure voice of command, while seconds trickle away, and it's up to you to be that voice, make decisions, give the right orders, and not only the right ones, but in a calm, unworried tone. Because it's a cinch, gentlemen, that your team is in trouble, bad trouble. And a strange voice with panic in it can turn the best combat team in the galaxy into a leaderless, lawless, fear-crazed mob. The whole merciless load will land without warning. You must act at once, and you'll have only God over you. Don't expect him to fill in tactical details. That's your job. He'll be doing all that a soldier has a right to expect, if he helps you keep the panic that you are sure to feel out of your voice. The colonel paused. I was sobered, and Bertie was looking terribly serious and awfully young, and Hassan was scowling. I wished that I were back in the drop room of the Raj, with not too many chevrons and an after-chow bull session in full swing. There was a lot to be said for the job of assistant section leader. When you come right to it, it's a lot easier to die than it is to use your head. The commandant continued. That's the moment of truth, gentlemen. Regrettably, there is no method known to military science to tell a real officer from a glib imitation with pips on his shoulders, other than through ordeal by fire. Real ones come through, or die, gallantly. Imitations crack up. Sometimes, in cracking up, the misfits die. But the tragedy lies in the loss of others. Good men, sergeants and corporals and privates, whose only lack is fatal bad fortune in finding themselves under the command of an incompetent. We try to avoid this. First is our unbreakable rule that every cadet must be a trained trooper, bloodied under fire, a veteran of combat drops. No other army in history has stuck to this rule, although some have come close. Most great military schools of the past, Saint-Cyr, West Point, Sandhurst, Colorado Springs, don't even pretend to follow it. They accepted civilian boys, trained them, commissioned them, sent them out with no battle experience to command men, and sometimes discover too late that this smart young officer was a fool, a poltroon, or a hysteric. At least we have no misfits of those sorts. We know you are good soldiers, brave and skilled, proved in battle, else you would not be here. We know that your intelligence and education meet acceptable minimums. With this to start on, we eliminate as many as possible of the not quite competent. Get them quickly back in ranks before we spoil good cap troopers by forcing them beyond their abilities. The course is very hard, because what will be expected of you later is still harder. In time, we have a small group whose chances look fairly good. The major criterion left untested is one we cannot test here. That undefinable something, which is the difference between a leader in battle and one who merely has the earmarks, but not the vocation. So we field test for it. Gentlemen, you have reached that point. Are you ready to take the oath? There was an instant of silence. Then Hassan, the assassin, answered firmly, "Yes, Colonel," and Bertie and I echoed. The colonel frowned. "I have been telling you how wonderful you are. Physically perfect, mentally alert, trained, disciplined, bloodied. The very model of the smart young officer." He snorted. "Nonsense. You may become officers someday. I hope so. We not only hate to waste money and time and effort, but also, and much more important, I shiver in my boots every time I send one of you half-baked, not-quite officers up to the fleet, knowing what a Frankensteinian monster I may be turning loose on a good combat team. If you understood what you're up against, you wouldn't be so all-fired ready to take the oath the second the question is put to you. You may turn it down and force me to let you go back to your permanent ranks, but you don't know. So I'll try once more. Mr. Rico, have you ever thought how it would feel to be court-martialed for losing a regiment?" I was startled silly. "Why, no, sir, I never have." "To be court-martialed, for any reason, is 8 times as bad for an officer as for an enlisted man. Offenses which will get privates kicked out, maybe with lashes, possibly without, rate death in an officer. Better never to have been born." "Think about it," he said grimly. "When I suggested that your platoon leader might be killed, I was by no means citing the ultimate in military disaster. Mr. Hassan, What is the largest number of command levels ever knocked out in a single battle? The assassin scowled harder than ever.
I'm not sure, sir. Wasn't there a while during Operation Buckhouse when a major commanded a brigade before the Sauve qui peut?
There was, and his name was Fredericks. He got a decoration and a promotion.
If you go back to the Second Global War, you can find a case in which a naval junior officer took command of a major ship and not only fought it, but sent signals as if he were admiral. He was vindicated, even though there were officers senior to him in line of command who were not even wounded. Special circumstances. A breakdown in communications. But I am thinking of a case in which four levels were wiped out in 6 minutes, as if a platoon leader were to blink his eyes and find himself commanding a brigade. Any of you heard of it?
Dead silence.
Very well. It was one of those bush wars that flared up on the edges of the Napoleonic Wars. This young officer was the most junior in a naval vessel. Wet navy, of course. Wind-powered, in fact. This youngster was about the age of most of your class. He was not commissioned. He carried the title of temporary third lieutenant. Note that this is the title you are about to carry. He had no combat experience. There were four officers in the chain of command above him. When the battle started, his commanding officer was wounded. The kid picked him up and carried him out of the line of fire.
That's all. Make a pickup on a comrade.
But he did it without being ordered to leave his post. The other officers all bought it while he was doing this, and he was tried for deserting his post of duty as commanding officer in the presence of the enemy. Convicted, cashiered.
I gasped.
For that, sir?
Why not? True, we make pickup. We do it under different circumstances from a wet navy battle, and by orders to the man making pickup.
But pickup is never an excuse for breaking off battle in the presence of the enemy. This boy's family tried for a century and a half to get his conviction reversed.
No luck, of course.
There was doubt about some circumstances, but no doubt that he had left his post during battle without orders. True, he was green as grass, but he was lucky not to be hanged.
Colonel Nielsen fixed me with a cold eye.
Mr. Rico, could this happen to you?
I gulped.
I hope not, sir.
Let me tell you how it could on this very Prentice cruise. Suppose you are in a multiple ship operation with a full regiment in the drop. Officers drop first, of course. There are advantages to this and disadvantages, but we do it for reasons of morale. No trooper ever hits the ground on a hostile planet without an officer. Assume the bugs know this, and they may. Suppose they work up some trick to wipe out those who hit the ground first, but not good enough to wipe out the whole drop. Now suppose, since you are a supernumerary, you have to take any vacant capsule instead of being fired with the first wave. Where does that leave you?
I'm not sure, sir.
You have just inherited command of a regiment. What are you going to do with your command, mister? Talk fast. The bugs won't wait.
I caught an answer right out of the book and parroted it.
I'll take command and act as circumstances permit, sir, according to the tactical situation as I see it.
You will, huh?
The colonel grunted.
And you'll buy a farm, too. That's all anybody can do with a foul-up like that.
But I hope you'll go down swinging and shouting orders to somebody, whether they make sense or not.
We don't expect kittens to fight wildcats and win. We merely expect them to try.
All right, stand up.
Put up your right hands.
He struggled to his feet.
30 seconds later, we were officers. Temporary, probationary, and supernumerary.
I thought he would give us our shoulder pips and let us go.
We aren't supposed to buy them. They're a loan. like the temporary commission they represent. Instead, he lounged back and looked almost human.
See here, lads. I gave you a talk on how rough it's going to be. I want you to worry about it. Doing it in advance, planning what steps you might take against any combination of bad news that can come your way. Keenly aware that your life belongs to your men and is not yours to throw away in a suicidal reach for glory. And that your life isn't yours to save either, if the situation requires that you expend it. I want you to worry yourself sick before a drop, so that you can be unruffled when the trouble starts. Impossible, of course, except for one thing. What is the only factor that can save you when the load is too heavy? Anyone?
Nobody answered.
Oh, come on, Colonel Nielsen said scornfully. You aren't recruits. Mr. Hassan?
Your leading sergeant, sir, the assassin said slowly.
Obviously. He's probably older than you are, more drops under his belt, and he certainly knows his team better than you do. Since he isn't carrying that dreadful, numbing load of top command, he may be thinking more clearly than you are. Ask his advice. You've got one circuit just for that.
It won't decrease his confidence in you. He's used to being consulted. If you don't, he'll decide you are a fool, a cocksure know-it-all. And he'll be right. But you don't have to take his advice. Whether you use his ideas or whether they spark some different plan, make your decision and snap out orders. The one thing, the only thing, that can strike terror in the heart of a good platoon sergeant is to find that he's working for a boss who can't make up his mind. There never has been an outfit in which officers and men were more dependent on each other than they are in the MI, and sergeants are the glue that holds us together. Never forget that.
The commandant whipped his chair around to a cabinet near his desk. It contained row on row of pigeonholes, each with a little box. He pulled out one and opened it.
Mr. Hassan?
Sir.
These pips were worn by Captain Terence O'Kelly on his Prentice cruise. Does it suit you to wear them?
Sir?
The assassin's voice squeaked, and I thought the big lunk was going to break into tears.
Yes, sir.
Come here.
Colonel Nielsen pinned them on, then said, Wear them gallantly, as he did, and bring them back. Understand me?
Yes, sir, I'll do my best.
I'm sure you will. There's an air car waiting on the road, and your boat boosts in 28 minutes. Carry out your orders, sir.
The assassin saluted and left. The commandant turned and picked out another box.
Mr. Bird, are you superstitious?
No, sir.
Really?
I am. Quite.
I take it you would not object to wearing pips which have been worn by 5 officers, all of whom were killed in action?
Birdie barely hesitated.
No, sir.
Good, because these 5 officers accumulated 17 citations, from the Terran Metal to the Wounded Lion.
Come here.
The pip with the brown discoloration must always be worn on your left shoulder, and don't try to buff it off. Just try not to get the other one marked in the same fashion, unless necessary. And you'll know when it is necessary.
Here is a list of former wearers. You have 30 minutes until your transportation leaves. Bounce up to Memorial Hall and look up the record of each.
Yes, sir.
Carry out your orders, sir.
He turned to me, looked at my face, and said sharply, Something on your mind, son? Speak up. I blurted it out.
Sir, that temporary third lieutenant, the one that got cashiered?
How could I find out what happened?
Oh.
Young man, I didn't mean to scare the daylights out of you. I simply intended to wake you up.
The battle was on 1 June 1813, old style, between USF Chesapeake and HMF Shannon. Try the Naval Encyclopedia. Your ship will have it. He turned back to the case of pips and frowned. Then he said, Mr. Rico, I have a letter from one of your high school teachers, a retired officer, requesting that you be issued the pips he wore as third lieutenant. I am sorry to say that I must tell him no.
Sir?
I was delighted to hear that Colonel Dubois was still keeping track of me, and very disappointed, too.
Because I can't. I issued those pips 2 years ago, and they never came back.
Real estate deal.
Hmm.
He took a box and looked at me.
You could start a new pair. The metal isn't important. The importance of the request lies in the fact that your teacher wanted you to have them.
Whatever you say, sir.
Or, he cradled the box in his hands, you could wear these. They have been worn 5 times, and the last 4 candidates to wear them have all failed of commission. Nothing dishonorable, but pesky bad luck. Are you willing to take a swing at breaking the hoodoo? Turn them into good luck pips instead?
I would rather have petted a shark.
But I answered, All right, sir, I'll take a swing at it.
Good.
He pinned them on me.
Thank you, Mr. Rico. You see, these were mine. I wore them first. And it would please me mightily to have them brought back to me with that streak of bad luck broken.
Have you go on and graduate?
I felt 10 feet tall.
I'll try, sir.
I know you will. You may now carry out your orders, sir. The same air car will take both you and Bird.
Just a moment.
Are your mathematics textbooks in your bag?
Sir?
No, sir.
Get them. The weightmaster of your ship has been advised of your extra baggage allowance.
I saluted and left, on the bounce. He had me shrunk down to size as soon as he had mentioned math. My math books were on my study desk, tied into a package with a daily assignment sheet tucked under the cord. I gathered the impression that Colonel Nielsen never left anything unplanned, but everybody knew that.
Bertie was waiting on the roof by the air car. He glanced at my books and grinned.
Too bad. Well, if we're in the same ship, I'll coach you.
What ship?
Tours.
Sorry, I'm for the Moskva.
We got in, I checked the pilot, saw that it had been preset for the field. Closed the door and the car took off.
Bertie added,
You could be worse off. The assassin took not only his math books, but 2 other subjects.
Bertie undoubtedly knew that he had not been showing off when he offered to coach me. He was a professor type, except that his ribbons proved that he was a soldier, too.
Instead of studying math, Bertie taught it. 1 period each day, he was a faculty member, the way little Sujumi taught judo at Camp Curie. The MI doesn't waste anything. We can't afford to.
Bertie had a BS in math on his 18th birthday.
So, naturally, he was assigned extra duty as instructor, which didn't keep him from being chewed out at other times. Not that he got chewed out much. Bertie had that rare combo of brilliant intellect, solid education, common sense, and guts, which gets a cadet marked as potential general. We figured he was a cinch to command a brigade by the time he was 30. What with the war. But my ambitions didn't soar that high. It would be a dirty, rotten shame, I said, if the assassin flunked out, while thinking that it would be a dirty, rotten shame if I flunked out.
He won't, Bertie answered cheerfully.
They'll sweat him through the rest, if they have to put him in a hypno booth and feed him through a tube.
Anyhow, he added,
Hassan could flunk out and get promoted for it.
Huh?
Didn't you know? The assassin's permanent rank is first lieutenant. Field commission, naturally. He reverts to it if he flunks out. See the regs?
I knew the regs. If I flunked math, I'd revert to buck sergeant, which is better than being slapped in the face with a wet fish any way you think about it. And I had thought about it, lying awake nights after busting a quiz. But this is different.
Hold it, I protested. He gave up first lieutenant, permanent grade, and has just made temporary third lieutenant?
In order to become a second lieutenant?
Are you crazy? Or is he?
Bertie grinned.
Just enough to make us both MI.
But I don't get it.
Sure you do. The assassin has no education that he didn't pick up in the MI. So how high can he go? I'm sure he could command a regiment in battle and do a real swinging job, provided somebody else planned the operation. But commanding in battle is only a fraction of what an officer does, especially a senior officer. To direct a war, or even to plan a single battle and mount the operation, you have to have theory of games, operational analysis, symbolic logic, pessimistic synthesis, and a dozen other skull subjects. You can sweat them out on your own if you've got the grounding, but have them you must, or you'll never get past captain, or possibly major. The assassin knows what he is doing.
I suppose so, I said slowly.
Bertie, Colonel Nielsen must know that Hassan was an officer. He is an officer, really.
Huh?
Of course.
He didn't talk as if he knew.
We all got the same lecture.
Not quite. Did you notice that when the commandant wanted a question answered a particular way, he always asked the assassin?
I decided it was true.
Bertie, what is your permanent rank?
The car was just landing. He paused with a hand on the latch and grinned.
PFC. I don't dare flunk out.
I snorted.
You won't. You can't.
I was surprised that he wasn't even a corporal, but a kid as smart and well-educated as Bertie would go to the OCS just as quickly as he proved himself in combat, which, with a war on, could be only months after his 18th birthday.
Bertie grinned still wider.
We'll see.
You'll graduate. Hassan and I had to worry, but not you.
So?
Suppose Miss Kendrick takes a dislike to me.
He opened the door and looked startled.
Hey, they're sounding my call. So long.
See you, Bertie.
But I didn't see him, and he did not graduate. He was commissioned 2 weeks later, and his pips came back with their 18th decoration. The Wounded Lion, posthumous.
13.
Yous guys think this, deleted, outfit is a blankety-blank nursery? Well, it ain't, see?
Remark attributed to a Hellenic corporal before the walls of Troy, 1194 BC. The Roger Young carries one platoon and is crowded. The Tours carries six and is roomy. She has the tubes to drop them all at once and enough spare room to carry twice that number and make a second drop. This would make her very crowded, with eating in shifts, hammocks and passageways and drop rooms, rationed water, inhale when your mate exhales, and get your elbow out of my eye. I'm glad they didn't double up while I was in her. She has the speed and lift to deliver such crowded troops still in fighting condition to any point in Federation space and much of bug space. Under Cherenkov drive, she cranks Mike 400 or better. Say, Seoul to Capella, 46 light years in under 6 weeks. Of course, a 6th platoon transport is not big compared with a battle wagon or passenger liner. These things are compromises. The MI prefers speedy little one-platoon corvettes, which give flexibility for any operation. While if it was left up to the Navy, we would have nothing but regimental transports. It takes almost as many Navy files to run a corvette as it does to run a monster big enough for a regiment. More maintenance and housekeeping, of course. But soldiers can do that. After all, those lazy troopers do nothing but sleep and eat and polish buttons. Do 'em good to have a little regular work. So says the Navy. The real Navy opinion is even more extreme. The Army is obsolete and should be abolished. The Navy doesn't say this officially, but talk to a Navy officer who is on R&R and feeling his oats. You'll get an earful. They think they can fight any war, win it, send a few of their own people down to hold the conquered planet until the diplomatic corps takes charge. I admit that their newest toys can blow any planet right out of the sky. I've never seen it, but I believe it. Maybe I'm as obsolete as Tyrannosaurus Rex. I don't feel obsolete. And us apes can do things that the fanciest ship cannot. If the government doesn't want those things done, no doubt they'll tell us. Maybe it's just as well that neither the Navy nor the MI has the final word. A man can't buck for Sky Marshal unless he's commanded both a regiment and a capital ship. Go through MI and take his lumps, and then become a naval officer. I think little Birdie had that in mind. Or first become an astrogator pilot and follow it with Camp Curie, etc. I'll listen respectfully to any man who has done both. Like most transports, the Tours was a mixed ship. The most amazing changes for me was to be allowed north of 30. The bulkhead that separates ladies' country from the rough characters who shave is not necessarily number 30, but by tradition, it is called bulkhead 30 in any mixed ship. The wardroom is just beyond it, and the rest of the ladies' country is farther forward. In the Tours, the wardroom is also served as messroom for enlisted women, who ate just before we did, and it was partitioned between meals into a recreation room for them and a lounge for their officers. Male officers had a lounge called the card room, just abaft 30. Besides the obvious fact that drop and retrieval require the best pilots, i.e. female, there is very strong reason why female Navy officers were assigned to transports. It is good for trooper morale. Let's skip MI traditions for a moment. Can you think of anything sillier than letting yourself be fired out of a spaceship with nothing but mayhem and sudden death at the other end? However, if someone must do this idiotic stunt, do you know of a surer way to keep a man keyed up to the point where he is willing than by keeping him constantly reminded that the only good reason why men fight is a living, breathing reality? In a mixed ship, the last thing a trooper hears before a drop, maybe the last word he ever hears, is a woman's voice wishing him luck. If you don't think this is important, you've probably resigned from the human race. The Tours had 15 naval officers, 8 ladies and 7 men. There were 8 MI officers, including, I am happy to say, myself. I won't say Bulkhead 30 caused me to buck for OCS, but the privilege of eating with the ladies is more incentive than any increase in pay. The skipper was president of the mess. My boss, Captain Blackstone, was vice president. Not because of rank. 3 naval officers ranked him. But as CO of the strike force, he was de facto senior to everybody but the skipper. Every meal was formal. We would wait in the card room until the hour struck, follow Captain Blackstone in and stand behind our chairs. The skipper would come in followed by her ladies and, as she reached the head of the table, Captain Blackstone would bow and say, Madam President, ladies. And she would answer, Mr. Vice, gentlemen. And the man on each lady's right would seat her. This ritual established that it was a social event, not an officers' conference. Thereafter, ranks or titles were used, except that junior naval officers and myself alone among the MI were called Mr. or Miss, with one exception which fooled me. My first meal aboard, I heard Captain Blackstone called Major, although his shoulder pips plainly read Captain. I got straightened out later. There can't be two captains in a Navy vessel, so an Army captain is bumped one rank socially, rather than commit the unthinkable of calling him by the title reserved for the one and only monarch. If a naval captain is aboard as anything but skipper, he or she is called Commodore, even if the skipper is a lowly lieutenant. The MI observes this by avoiding the necessity in the wardroom and paying no attention to the silly custom on our own part of the ship. Seniority ran downhill from each end of the table, with the skipper at the head and the strike force CO at the foot, the junior midshipman at his right, and myself at the skipper's right. I would most happily have sat by the junior midshipman. She was awfully pretty. But the arrangement is planned chaperonage. I never even learned her first name. I knew that I, as the lowliest male, sat on the skipper's right, but I didn't know that I was supposed to seat her. At my first meal, she waited, and nobody sat down, until the third assistant engineer jogged my elbow. I haven't been so embarrassed since a very unfortunate incident in kindergarten, even though Captain Jorgensen acted as if nothing had happened. When the skipper stands up, the meal is over. She was pretty good about this, but once she stayed seated only a few minutes, and Captain Blackstone got annoyed. He stood up, but called out, "Captain?" She stopped. "Yes, Major." "Will the captain please give orders that my officers and myself be served in the card room?" She answered coldly, "Certainly, sir." And we were, but no naval officer joined us. The following Saturday, she exercised her privilege of inspecting the MI aboard, which transport skippers almost never do. However, she simply walked down the ranks without comment. She was not really a martinet, and she had a nice smile when she wasn't being stern. Captain Blackstone assigned Second Lieutenant Rusty Graham to crack the whip over me about math. She found out about it somehow and told Captain Blackstone to have me report to her office for 1 hour after lunch each day. Whereupon she tutored me in math and bawled me out when my homework wasn't perfect. Our six platoons were two companies in a rump battalion. Captain Blackstone commanded Company D, Blackie's Blackguards, and also commanded the rump battalion. Our battalion commander by the TO, Major Zira, was with A and B companies in the Tours' sister ship, Normandy Beach, maybe half a sky away. He commanded us only when the full battalion dropped together, except that Captain Blackie routed certain reports and letters through him. Other materials went directly to fleet, division, or base. And Blackie had a truly wizard fleet sergeant to keep such things straight, and to help him handle both a company and a rump battalion in combat. Administrative details are not simple in any army spread through many light years and hundreds of ships. In the old Valley Forge, in the Roger Young, and now in the Tours, I was in the same regiment, the 3rd Pampered Pets Regiment of the 1st Polaris MI Division. Two battalions formed from available units had been called the 3rd Regiment in Operation Bughouse, but I did not see my regiment. All I saw was PFC Bamberger and a lot of bugs. I might be commissioned in the Pampered Pets, grow old and retire in it, and never even see my regimental commander. The Roughnecks had a company commander, but he also commanded the 1st Platoon, Hornets, in another corvette. I didn't know his name until I saw it on my orders to OCS. There is a legend about a lost platoon that went on R&R as its corvette was decommissioned. Its company commander had just been promoted, and the other platoons had been attached tactically elsewhere. I've forgotten what happened to the platoon's lieutenant, but R&R is a routine time to detach an officer, theoretically after a relief has been sent to understudy him. But reliefs are always scarce. They say this platoon enjoyed a local year of the fleshpots along Churchill Road before anybody missed them. I don't believe it, but it could happen. The chronic scarcity of officers strongly affected my duties in Blackie's Blackguards. The MI has the lowest percentage of officers in any army of record, and this factor is just part of the MI's unique divisional wedge. DW is military jargon, but the idea is simple. If you have 10,000 soldiers, how many fight? And how many just peel potatoes, drive lorries, count graves, and shuffle papers? In the MI, 10,000 men fight. In the mass wars of the 20th century, it sometimes took 70,000 men, fact, to enable 10,000 to fight. I admit it takes the Navy to place us where we fight. However, an MI strike force, even in a corvette, is at least 3 times as large as the transport's Navy crew. It also takes civilians to supply and service us. About 10% of us are on R&R at any time, and a few of the very best of us are rotated to instruct at boot camps. While a few MI are on desk jobs, you will always find that they are shy an arm or leg or some such. These are the ones, the Sergeant Hose and the Colonel Nielsens, who refuse to retire, and they really ought to count twice, since they release able-bodied MI by filling jobs which require fighting spirit but not physical perfection. They do work that civilians can't do, or we would hire civilians. Civilians are like beans. You buy them as needed for any job which merely requires skill and savvy. But you can't buy fighting spirit. It's scarce. We use all of it, waste none. The MI is the smallest army in history for the size of population it guards. You can't buy an MI. You can't conscript him. You can't coerce him. You can't even keep him if he wants to leave. He can quit 30 seconds before a drop, lose his nerve, and not get into his capsule. And all that happens is that he is paid off and can never vote. At OCS, we studied armies in history that were driven like galley slaves. But the MI is a free man. All that drives him comes from inside. That self-respect and need for the respect of his mates, and his pride in being one of them, called morale, or esprit de corps. The root of our morale is, everybody works, everybody fights. An MI doesn't pull strings to get a soft, safe job. There aren't any. Oh, a trooper will get away with what he can. Any private with enough savvy to mark time to music can think up reasons why he should not clean compartments or break out stores. This is a soldier's ancient right. But all soft, safe jobs are filled by civilians. The gold-bricking private climbs into his capsule certain that everybody, from general to private, is doing it with him. Light years away, and on a different day, or maybe an hour or so later, no matter. What does matter is that everybody drops. This is why he enters the capsule, even though he may not be conscious of it. If we ever deviate from this, the MI will go to pieces. All that holds us together is an idea, one that binds more strongly than steel, but its magic power depends on keeping it intact. It is this everybody fights rule that lets the MI get by with so few officers. I know more about this than I want to, because I asked a foolish question in military history and got stuck with an assignment which forced me to dig up stuff ranging from De Bello Gallico to Tsing's classic Collapse of the Golden Hegemony. Consider an ideal MI division. On paper, because you won't find one elsewhere. How many officers does it require? Never mind units attached from other corps. They may not be present during a ruckus. They are not like MI. The special talents attached to logistics and communications are all ranked as officers. If it will make a memory man, a telepath, a censor, or a lucky man happy to have me salute him, I'm glad to oblige. He is more valuable than I am, and I could not replace him if I lived to be 200. Or take the canine corps, which is 50% officers, but whose other 50% are neo-dogs. None of these is in line of command. So let's consider only us apes and what it takes to lead us. The imaginary division has 10,800 men in 216 platoons, each with a lieutenant. Three platoons to a company calls for 72 captains. Four companies to a battalion calls for 18 majors or lieutenant colonels. Six regiments with six colonels can form two or three brigades, each with a short general, plus a medium-tall general as top brass. You wind up with 317 officers out of a total, all ranks, of 11,117. There are no blank files, and every officer commands a team. Officers total 3%, which is what the MI does have, but arranged somewhat differently. In fact, a good many platoons are commanded by sergeants, and many officers wear more than one hat in order to fill some utterly necessary staff jobs. Even a platoon leader should have staff, his platoon sergeant. But he can get by without one, and his sergeant can get by without him. But a general must have staff. The job is too big to carry in his hat. He needs a big planning staff and a small combat staff. Since there are never enough officers, the team commanders in his flag transport double as his planning staff and are picked from the MI's best mathematical logicians. Then they drop with their own teams. The general drops with a small combat staff, plus a small team of the roughest, on-the-bounce troopers in the MI. Their job is to keep the general from being bothered by rude strangers while he is managing the battle. Sometimes they succeed. Besides necessary staff billets, any team larger than a platoon ought to have a deputy commander. There are never enough officers, so we make do with what we've got. To fill each necessary combat billet, one job to one officer, would call for a 5% ratio of officers. But 3% is all we've got. In place of that optimax of 5% that the MI never can reach, many armies in the past commissioned 10% of their number, or even 15%, and sometimes a preposterous 20%. This sounds like a fairy tale, but it was a fact, especially during the 20th century. What kind of army has more officers than corporals, and more non-coms than privates? An army organized to lose wars, if history means anything. An army that is mostly organization, red tape, and overhead, most of whose soldiers never fight. But what do officers do who do not command fighting men? Fiddlework, apparently. Officers club officer, morale officer, athletics officer, public information officer, recreation officer, PX officer, transportation officer, legal officer, chaplain, assistant chaplain, junior assistant chaplain, officer in charge of anything anybody can think of, even nursery officer. In the MI, such things are extra duty for combat officers, or if they are real jobs. They are done better and cheaper and without demoralizing a fighting outfit by hiring civilians. But the situation got so smelly in one of the 20th century major powers that real officers, ones who commanded fighting men, were given special insignia to distinguish them from the swarms of swivel-chaired hussars. The scarcity of officers got steadily worse as the war wore on, because the casualty rate is always highest among officers, and the MI never commissions a man simply to fill vacancy. In the long run, each boot regiment must supply its own share of officers, and the percentage can't be raised without lowering the standards. The strike force in the tours needed 13 officers, 6 platoon leaders,
two company commanders and two deputies, and a strike force commander staffed by a deputy and an adjunct. What it had was six. And me. Table of Organization, Rump Battalion Strike Force. Captain Blackstone, First Hat, Fleet Sergeant. Company C, Warren's Wolverines. First Lieutenant Warren. First Platoon, First Lieutenant Bayonne. Second Platoon, Second Lieutenant Sucarnaro. Third Platoon, Second Lieutenant Nagain. D Company, Blackie's Blackards. Captain Blackstone, Second Hat. First Platoon, First Lieutenant Silva, hospitalized. Second Platoon, Second Lieutenant Koroshin. Third Platoon, Second Lieutenant Graham. I would have been under Lieutenant Silva, but he left for the hospital the day I reported, ill with some sort of twitching awfuls. But this did not necessarily mean that I would get his platoon. A temporary third lieutenant is not considered an asset. Captain Blackstone could place me under Lieutenant Bayonne and put a sergeant in charge of his own first platoon, or even put on a third hat and take the platoon himself. In fact, he did both, and nevertheless assigned me as platoon leader of the first platoon of the Blackguards. He did this by borrowing the Wolverine's best buck sergeant to act as his battalion staffer. Then he placed his fleet sergeant as platoon sergeant of his first platoon, a job two grades below his chevrons. Then Captain Blackstone spelled it out for me in a head-shrinking lecture. I would appear on the TO as platoon leader, but Blackie himself and the fleet sergeant would run the platoon. As long as I behaved myself, I could go through the motions. I would even be allowed to drop as platoon leader. But one word from my platoon sergeant to my company commander, and the jaws of the nutcracker would close. It suited me. It was my platoon as long as I could swing it, and if I couldn't, the sooner I was shoved aside, the better for everybody. Besides, it was a lot less nerve-wracking to get a platoon that way than by sudden catastrophe in battle. I took my job very seriously, for it was my platoon. The TO said so. But I had not yet learned to delegate authority, and, for about a week, I was around troopers' country much more than is good for a team. Blackie called me into his stateroom. "Son, what in Ned do you think you're doing?" I answered stiffly that I was trying to get my platoon ready for action. "So? Well, that's not what you are accomplishing. You are stirring them like a nest of wild bees. Why the deuce do you think I turned over to you the best sergeant in the fleet? If you will go to your stateroom, hang yourself on a hook and stay there until 'prepare for action' is sounded, he'll hand that platoon over to you tuned like a violin." "As the captain pleases, sir," I agreed, glumly. "And that's another thing. I can't stand an officer who acts like a confounded cadet. Forget that silly third-person talk around me. Save it for generals and the skipper. Quit bracing your shoulders and clicking your heels. Officers are supposed to look relaxed, son." "Yes, sir." "And let that be the last time you say sir to me for one solid week. Same for saluting. Get that grim cadet look off your face and hang a smile on it." "Yes, sir." "Okay. That's better. Lean against the bulkhead. Scratch yourself, yawn. Anything but that tin soldier act." I tried, and grinned sheepishly as I discovered that breaking a habit is not easy. Leaning was harder work than standing at attention. Captain Blackstone studied me. "Practice it," he said. "An officer can't look scared or tense. It's contagious. Now, tell me, Johnny, what your platoon needs. Never mind the piddling stuff. I'm not interested in whether a man has the regulation number of socks in his locker." I thought rapidly. "Do you happen to know if Lieutenant Silva intended to put Brumby up for sergeant?"